This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Bone Farm, a Jane Hawk case file by Dean Koontz. Performed by Elizabeth Rogers and James Anderson Foster.
One.
I've never killed anyone, Gary Burkett said. Have you ever killed anyone?
Not yet, said Jane Hawk. Wounded a couple.
Do you think you're capable of killing someone?
I better be. So would you. She drove fast, eager to conduct the final interview of the day and then head home to Alexandria, which would be a 3-hour drive. She had been away from her husband, Nick, and her boy, Travis, for 3 days, and although she took great satisfaction in her work, she loved her family more. The long shadows strained toward the east, as if yearning to join the wave of night that would soon break across that horizon. Small towns and smaller hamlets. Dairy farms where herds of cows ambled barnward at day's end. Cornfields cut to stubble, readied for the hitch and harrow. The drone of the Suburban's tires on the County 2 lane was a monotonous song of weariness. This had been a grim and tedious day in a bucolic landscape. However, she reminded herself, tedium can become terror from one moment to the next.
I'm 32, Gary said. Been in the Bureau 9 years, a lot longer than you, and never doubted I could kill a bad guy if it came to that, but something's different now that...
Now that what?
Now that I'm going to be a father.
His wife, Rosalyn, was 5 months pregnant.
If I have to kill someone, what will my daughter think of that when she's grown up and has her own opinions?
She's going to be an FBI kid, Gary. She'll understand bad guys and how they sometimes have to be stopped cold.
Probably she will. But you never know about kids.
Half the early September sky was ablaze, and across the other half, sapphire blue darkled toward black as the stars prepared to come on stage. Assigned to the Critical Incident Response Group, she and Gary were in South Central Pennsylvania, interviewing family and friends of a kidnapped 20-year-old college student. Catherine Haskell was the 22nd victim of a serial killer whom the worst of the tabloid press had labeled the mother hater. She'd disappeared 6 days earlier. 3 days after she went missing, her mother received an envelope postmarked Cumberland, Maryland. It contained a photograph of Kathy on a wooden stool in front of a sky blue wall. She was naked and looked terrified. 21 other mothers had received photos of their daughters within a week of their disappearance, postmarked in a variety of northeastern cities and states. A second photo came between 2 and 4 months later. The missing girl, again naked, but now brutalized and dead, lying on bare earth as if on the brink of a grave. However ruthlessly the killer had used Kathy during the past 6 days, at least she wasn't dead. He didn't kill them until he tired of them. The high-quality photos were not embedded with any smartphone signifiers. They were taken with a camera, but the Bureau lab could not identify the manufacturer. The brand of photographic paper was sold in 49 of the 50 states. No fingerprints. The self-sealing envelopes didn't require the sender to lick the glue line, which eliminated the possibility of finding DNA material from dried saliva. The killer had access to a photographic lab, but it was likely a small in-home hobby setup, untraceable. Months of investigation of commercial labs and photographers had turned up nothing of value.
Are you sure your boy would understand you're killing someone?
Travis is 3, Gary. He's not yet brooding about justifiable homicide.
But you're confident he'll understand when he grows up?
Yes, because Nick and I will teach him how the world really works, not how some people wish it worked. Just like you and Rosalind will teach your daughter. The voice of the GPS assured them that they had arrived at Gossage Farm, and Jane turned right onto the long private drive that led to the house. Overhanging oaks roofed a lane of oiled earth. She switched on the headlights. The trees were only partly dressed in autumn color, still more green than purple-red. None of the first 21 victims had been snatched in Pennsylvania. They had vanished from places in Ohio, New York, New Jersey, Maryland, and West Virginia. The youngest had been 15, the oldest, 23. At first, it had seemed significant that the mother-hater had begun hunting in new territory. But interviews with those who knew Kathy, coupled with the details of her life and disappearance, had turned up not a single fact that suggested anything different about the killer's choice of this victim, nothing that might lead them to him. Exactly where she had disappeared was not known. Her car, a 10-year-old Honda, remained missing. 3 days among the girl's grieving loved ones had left a grayness in Jane's soul and a secondhand sorrow in her heart. The handsome house at the end of the oak-shaded lane faced west, so that by reflection the burning portion of the sky rouged the clapboard that would be white in daylight. Mercer Gossage, a cousin of Kathy Haskell's mother, Anita, must have heard the suburban approaching. He waited on the porch. A tall, imposing man of 44, country royalty. The 300-acre farm had passed from his grandfather to his father and, just 5 years earlier, to Mercer through his widowed mother's will. He welcomed Gary Burkett and Jane up the porch steps and shook their hands. His smile was sewn through with a sadness, also apparent in his blue eyes, but he seemed naturally cordial and perhaps could not, by his very constitution, imagine introducing himself without a smile, even in solemn situations.
I brewed a fresh pot of coffee. I warn you, it is to Starbucks what grapefruit juice is to Dom Perignon, but you're welcome to it. If you'll just follow me through to the kitchen, we can do this there.
Jane didn't want coffee. In fact, she felt that they were to some small extent surrendering control of the interview by accepting Gossage's hospitality. But before she could decline, Gary said he could use a cup. 4 grandfather clocks stood along the ground floor hallway, pendulums swinging, mechanisms softly clicking away the seconds.
My mother collected antique clocks, Gossage said. Long case clocks like these, but also bracket clocks, carriage clocks, mantel clocks. For the longest time, I thought it was a little batty, but then slowly I began to appreciate the beauty of them. And now I'm just as much a clock nut as she was.
Through archways to the living room and dining room, Jane saw overdone, indeed fussy, Victorian decor and fireplaces that each bore 3 large clocks. Beyond the open door to a study were walls lined with shelves on which stood a small fortune in antique clocks, ornate gilt bronze and Buell and Toll and porcelain clocks. The contemporary-style kitchen featured white cabinets, black granite counters, and modern appliances, but 2 grandfather clocks flanked the back door, each with a marquetry case, exotic wood inlays depicting elaborate floral designs.
William and Mary Long Cases by John Wise, Gossage said of the clocks. Late 17th century.
Jane was a pianist and understood the passion for collecting, whether clocks or, in her case, vinyl recordings of piano masters like Arthur Rubinstein and Glenn Gould. However, sometimes passion could metastasize into obsession, and when that happened, there was the possibility that the collection was a symptom of one kind of mental disorder or another. The aroma of fresh-brewed coffee was so appealing that Jane did not object when Gossage poured 3 cups rather than 2. Gary Burkett said,
"So many clocks and so little ticking." Oh, said Gossage as the three of them sat at the table. Mom and I muffled the mechanisms. Otherwise, I would have ended up in a madhouse. Well, maybe I did, after all. I had a 10-year career in politics.
At 26, he had been elected to the County Board of Supervisors. At 30, he was chairman of it. Following that, he'd been elected to the state legislature. Some, including his cousin Anita Haskell, were among those who thought he might one day be governor. Considering that the man had such charisma and an appealing habit of self-deprecation, Jane wondered, "Why did you give it up?" He frowned and shook his head.
"There are so few people in that world with honor, so many driven by greed or a lust for power. You never know who to trust. I was naive when I got into it. Eventually, I didn't have the stomach for politics." "Good coffee," said Gary.
Gossage smiled.
"No offense intended, Agent Burkett, but the way you say that with a straight face, maybe you'd do all right in politics."
In fact, the coffee was excellent, and the way Gossage modestly disclaimed the praise struck Jane as entirely political. "Your cousin Anita says you understood Kathy as well as anyone, that you literally turned the girl's life around when she went off the rails at 14.
"Anita credits me too much. She's a single mom, but a great one. Kathy was just in rebellion. Disobedience was her identity. Hanging with the wrong crowd, a pothead boyfriend. I've told Anita 100 times it was hardly me at all. It was mainly Lenore, my mother, who got through to Kathy back then, got her back on the rails. This was a year before Mom died. She was 69, but young at heart. Kathy loved my mom. Nearly everyone did."
2. The following is a compilation of extracts from the journal of Mercer Gossage, begun when he was 14, in which he never refers to himself as I, only by his name and as he.
Mercer has long suffered anxiety regarding his hateful father. Mercer suffers because he has a very great destiny. A very great destiny requires suffering in preparation for it. Mother says Mercer has a great destiny, and Mother can't lie because she is love. She is pure love. She says pure love cannot lie. Mercer's father, Vernon, is one of those rare people who do not love Mercer's saintly mother, Lenore. But then, Vernon doesn't love anyone. He is a distant, icy man who seems happiest, if he is ever happy, when he's engaged in some endeavor alone, fishing or hunting or horseback riding. Vernon's meager capacity for affection is reserved for his horses and his pickup truck. Vernon does not seem to love his only child. Mercer suspects this by the time he is 6, and when Mercer asks Mother if his father loves him, she says, "Your daddy loves himself so much that he doesn't have any left over for anyone else." Lenore has always showered Mercer with a mother's love, cuddles and pets him as she might a beloved dog if she liked dogs. And after she answers his question about his father, she takes 6-year-old Mercer into her arms, but also into her confidence to a greater and most remarkable extent. From that day forward, she shares with Mercer every selfish act committed by Vernon, every meanness and insult and lie, every act of infidelity. Vernon has other women, and he doesn't care if Lenore knows it. Indeed, Vernon tells her about them in the most vicious and taunting manner. By the time Mercer is 10, he is also privy to every intimate turn of his mother's life. He knows specifically how his father uses her in bed, how he hurts her and humiliates her and knows no limits to his cruelty. This makes Mercer angry, so angry that Mercer wants to hurt his father. But his loving mother cuddles him and pets him, gentling him, because anger harms no one but the person who harbors it. She is the best mother. She is the best mother in the world, and so patient with her hateful husband. She is not angry with Vernon, only sad and terribly hurt. Many is the night when, home alone together, Mercer and Mother have a good long cry over the terrible suffering that she endures. Vernon has been willed the farm by his father, but Lenore's inheritance and the income it spins off make it possible for Vernon to forego farming and devote himself to fishing, hunting, horseback riding, and serial adultery. He is shit. Mercer's father is a piece of shit. From time to time, he sells off a parcel of land and, over the years, diminishes the property from 500 acres to 300. But the money he receives is spent on his whores and other pleasures. He is a whoremonger, and he has no shame, while, like a leech, he lives off Mother's investment income. She worries that one day he will have sold off all the land and will have impoverished them with his gambling debts. But she is afraid to leave him for fear that he will harm her and Mercer. She often recounts for Mercer the threats that Vernon has made to kill them both and free himself from marriage and fatherhood. Mercer is blessed to have such a mother who cherishes him and tells him only truths, even the hard truths about his father and her suffering. She devotes herself tirelessly to Mercer and homeschools him to keep him safe, for he can never be safe in either public or private schools where there are boys of the worst character, young wolves. Mercer would be so alone without her. Even with Mother here for him whenever he needs her, Mercer sometimes feels desperately alone, lost and alone, as though he is the last person on earth. He steps outside and runs into the yard and turns in a circle, and there is no one in sight. The hundreds of unworked acres all around, no traffic noises even from a distance, no sound except the breeze whispering through the trees, the sky empty and the land fallow. He fears that time has stopped, that there is no future anymore, that nothing will change, that he is trapped alone in this moment, pinned to this one eternal minute, pinned like a butterfly to a collector's board. When that mood overcomes him and a quiet panic begins to rise in Mercer's blood, he runs to Mother. She calms him, reassures him that he is not alone and never will be as long as she lives. When Mercer's 16, Father is thrown by a horse and dies of a broken neck. Neither Mercer nor Mother grieves, but in fact, they celebrate with cake and ice cream as though it is a birthday, not a death day. The hateful whoremonger is dead. The whoremonger is dead, dead and will always be dead. After that, everything is perfect. Peace and pure love and happiness. Lenore continues to homeschool Mercer, and they are never apart. The two of them stand together against the wicked world, and oh, the world is dark and populated by predatory people who would steal every dime from a widow and her child, leaving them homeless and starving. But they are safe as long as they have each other and only each other. Mercer has no need of a girlfriend. A girlfriend would only be the female equivalent of his father, a dirty slut who would betray him with any man who wanted her. No woman can be trusted as Mother can be trusted. Mercer has a very great destiny, and nothing can destroy his great destiny sooner than a dirty little slut who will cuckold him and hold him up to public ridicule. To relieve Mercer of the need for a girl of his own, 5 years ago, when he was 11, Lenore showed him what any boy can do for himself in the privacy of his room to make a girl unnecessary. Ever since, by mail, she has purchased for Mercer thrilling magazines, then even more thrilling videos and eventually DVD movies to facilitate his erotic fantasies and spare him the mortal danger of real girls. When Mercer is 26, he runs for a seat on the county board of supervisors and wins, for the sole purpose of shepherding through certain land use changes that will increase the value of his precious mother's property, so she will never again have to worry about becoming destitute. When he goes away to the state legislature for a similar purpose, he still comes home from Harrisburg 6 nights a week. During 2 years in Harrisburg, he achieves what Mother needs from the state government, and he is through with politics, which is a dirty business better suited to the late Vernon Gossage than to his son, who has never been with whores and never will be. Mercer never spends another night away from home. He is 39 when Mother dies of a stroke. Mercer feels as though a part of himself has perished as well. Something inside him, at the very center of him, has imploded and blackened and taken upon itself the gravity of a dead star. Mercer puts on a very brave front publicly, but cries himself to sleep night after night. His grief is nearly disabling, and the loss so embitters him that he considers torturing and killing her physician, who damn well should have recognized the threat to that precious woman. The hateful doctor is incompetent, or worse, he is a dirty whoremonger like Vernon. He is a whoremonger and hated Mother for the purity of her love. However, as Mother taught him, anger only harms the one who harbors it. So Mercer must gentle himself. The dense, dead star at the center of Mercer is pulling him into its absolute darkness. But Mercer smiles and puts on a brave front. As Mother taught him, it is at all times essential to put on a brave front, to hide one's fears and truest feelings, because this sad world is full of wolves in human clothing, wolves who will exploit your every fear and weakness until they destroy you. The 5 months following Mother's death are grim, a test of Mercer's ability to maintain self-control and prepare for his great destiny. As hasn't happened in many years, he now again and often finds himself standing in the yard, turning in a circle, alone and lost under the empty sky, in all that fallow land, the last human being on earth, pinned to this eternal minute, with no future forthcoming. But then everything changes dramatically one day when he answers the doorbell and finds that he has come calling on himself. Mercer Gossage faces Mercer Gossage through the screen door, one of them in the foyer, the other on the porch.
3. Flying hard-shell beetles clicked against the kitchen windows in pursuit of light. Tall, muffled clocks chased the future second by second. Mercer Gossage stirred his coffee rather than drink it, clinking the spoon against the cup, stirred not to cool the coffee, because the coffee was already cool enough to sip, but as though he wanted to transform the brew into something else. He spoke movingly of the kidnapped girl, Kathy Haskell, of her mother's pain on receiving the photograph sent by the killer. His grief seemed genuine and profound, unshed tears in his eyes. Yet Jane Hawke found him vaguely disturbing. He directly met their eyes and answered all their questions about Kathy and the bad crowd that she had hung with for a while when she had been 14. He didn't seem in any way evasive or insincere or nervous, except for how he kept stirring the coffee. Sometimes he looked down at the cup for a minute or so,
nearly always when emotion threatened to get the better of him. Perhaps he'd known he would inevitably be shaken by grief. He spoke of Kathy and her parents with such fondness, and had wanted the coffee only as a distraction toward which he could shift his attention when he needed to collect himself. Yes, perhaps. But perhaps not. More often than not, when he lowered his gaze to the cup and the tireless spoon, he glanced surreptitiously at his wristwatch, as if impatient with the passage of time and eager for an end to their questions. The William and Mary long cases flanking the back door were behind Gossage. When again he furtively consulted his watch, Jane looked past him at those tall clocks and realized that they didn't present the same time. In fact, as the minute hand of that to the left of the door softly clicked forward one check, the comparable hand on that to the right of the door simultaneously clicked backward one check. "One of those clocks is running backward," she said. Raising his eyes from his coffee, Gossage managed an expression of melancholy amusement.
"Yes, that's right. My mother, Lenore, was the dearest woman. But she had her superstitions."
Gary Burkett frowned.
"What superstition is satisfied by jiggering a clock to run backward?" "Mother was superstitious, and, I regret to say, afflicted with just the littlest bit of dementia in her last years. She convinced herself that if some clocks were counting forward while others counted backward, then time would stand still in this house, so she wouldn't age further and wouldn't die."
"Are you saying that half of all the clocks in this place are rigged to run backward?" Gary asked.
Jane said nothing, but watched intently as Gossage shrugged his big shoulders and summoned again that smile of melancholy amusement.
"It's a lot of clocks, I'll grant you, but it meant so much to her, and she meant so much to me. I didn't mind all the tinkering with them. It made her happy."
"That's very sweet," Jane said, though she didn't think it was sweet at all, but perhaps indicative of obsession. "How long ago did your mother pass, Mr. Gossage?"
4 years, 6 months, almost to the day."
4.
Mercer stares at himself through the screen door. For a moment, certain this is how death visits those he reaps. Not in a hooded black robe and carrying a wicked scythe, but as the very image of the person whose life he has come to end, as if to say, "You exist now in me, no longer in the world." Mercer never knew he had an identical twin. The resemblance is remarkable. Although they haven't met until now, Mercer and his double dress in similar clothes and even sport similar hairstyles. If one of them weighs a few pounds more than the other, the eye cannot detect the heavier of the two. The fateful visitor's name is Jack Crockett, and he has been seeking his twin brother for 3 years, in spite of the resistance of the church-associated adoption agency and authorities. His skill as a computer hacker and his disdain for laws and protocols have served him well in the search. Jack brings with him a bottle of Macallan Scotch to celebrate their reunion. The choice of this fine whiskey is extraordinary. Mother did not approve the consumption of alcohol. While Lenore was alive, Mercer respected her wishes and did not imbibe. Since her death, however, Mercer has taken consolation in Scotch, and it is this very brand that he drinks. They adjourn to the kitchen, where each takes 2 fingers of whiskey. Neat. Mercer first assumes that Mother delivered twins and that his hateful father, who had no use for children, would not tolerate 2 of them in the house. But the truth is different and devastating. Mercer is not his mother's child. He is adopted. Both he and Jack are the children of a former prostitute named Brandy Wines, who put them both up for adoption. Brandy still lives. Jack found her before he found Mercer. Because Brandy used birth control when with a John, but not when in bed with her main man, a pimp named Dewey Gorton, that whoremaster is almost certainly their father. If pure love cannot lie, which Mother often told Mercer, then she, Lenore, was not pure love, as she claimed. Mother deceived him about the most fundamental things, his origin, his heritage, and she encouraged all her relatives to cooperate with her in this shocking deception. Mother lied to Mercer as well about his great destiny, which she had never defined. With my guidance, my lovely boy, you've kept yourself pure, allowed no girl to seduce you, which has prepared you for a great destiny. It isn't for me to say what that destiny might be, although I know. Oh, my dear child, I know, but it is for you to discover. I must never rob you of the delight, the joy that will come with the surprise of discovering your great destiny. However, Mercer is the child of a whore and a pimp, raised by a liar, and he can't see how someone with roots as twisted as his can grow into a great destiny. He is 39, and alone, and waiting for a great destiny that does not exist. Mercer has never been an angry person. Mother smoothed away his anger each time that it arose, cuddled and petted him as she might have gentled a beloved dog if she liked dogs. But she didn't like dogs, and maybe she didn't like Mercer very much either. Maybe she manipulated and used him, lied and manipulated and used. The black hole that has existed at the core of him ever since Mother died, the dense, dead star of depression, slowly begins to change in character. It becomes a simmering anger. Mercer is frightened by the potential of that anger to fester and grow. Jack Crockett has no problem with anger. He thrives on it. He didn't take well to his adopted family and hasn't seen them since he was 17. He was his father's son and proud of it. His research has shown him that the late Dewey Gorton was a badass dude who took what he wanted and did what he wanted. And anyone who got in his way regretted crossing him. Jack pours another two fingers of scotch for each of them. Sitting at the kitchen table, listening to his brother, Mercer feels that not only has he been lied to, but also has lived a lie his entire life. Mercer has never known who he really is, has not been allowed to know. Jack is colorful. Jack is funny. Jack has known many adventures, much excitement. Jack has been everywhere and has endless colorful stories to tell. Jack takes no shit from anyone. Jack is the Mercer that Mercer was never given the chance to be. Jack will stay with Mercer for a while. He must stay. They have to get to know each other. For months, Mercer has not been able to see his future or to find any way to get there. Jack Crockett is a door to the future. When Jack brings his luggage and a lot of photography gear in from his white Chevy van, he also brings a girl named Danica. Mercer was not aware that she had been waiting in the vehicle. She is in her early 20s, slim but full-breasted. Blonde hair, green eyes, she moves with the grace of light. Mercer cannot stop looking at her. She is as desirable as any of the hot girls in the thrilling magazines and movies that his mother bought for him over the years, beginning when he was not yet quite 12. Jack and Danica sleep in Mercer's old room because shortly after Mother's death, Mercer had taken to sleeping in her bed. On the third night after the brothers begin to share the house, Mercer awakens when Danica turns back the covers and, naked, slips into Mother's bed. Surely she has had too much to drink, has confused the rooms, and believes she is bedding down with the twin who brought her. But she says, "Jack sent me. He thinks you need this." Sometimes Mercer has awakened in the night, sure that Mother's spirit haunts this bedroom. Coupling with Danica is an exorcism. The next day, Mercer and Danica do not come downstairs until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, whereupon Mercer discovers that Jack has been working on some of the clocks to make them run backward. Until now, Mercer hasn't noticed that Jack wears 2 wristwatches. The first counts time forward while the hands on the second move steadily counterclockwise. One of the exotic places that Jack knows well is New Orleans, where he met an old black woman, Mama Dede Labrique, who not only practices voodoo but is queen of a cult. She gave him this watch that breaks the basic rule of all clocks. On the back of the casing is engraved a voodoo veve. According to Mama Dede Labrique, wearing her watch on one wrist and an ordinary watch on the other ensures that Jack will live at least to 113 in perfect health, possibly forever, and that until his last day he will perform sexually as though he is 18. Jack says, "Man, with all these clocks, if half are running forward and half backward, this whole house will be a place outside of time, and no one in it will ever age. It's like my destiny to find you and be here. My destiny, bro, and yours." At that moment, Mercer decides that no one must know Jack is here. The situation is magical, yes, magical. It is a very magical situation, as though another, more exciting version of himself stepped out of a looking glass and brought with him a princess, and the magic can best be sustained in secrecy.
5. Only Gary Burkett drank the coffee. Mercer Gossage stirred his ceaselessly, and after a single sip, Jane let hers get cold. When Gossage said that his mother had been dead 4 years and 6 months, Jane said, "And you haven't fixed all these backward-running clocks in all that time?" Gossage selected a wistful version from his deep catalog of charming smiles. "The clocks running backward. They remind me how cute Mother was, how sweet. They make me smile." Jane pushed aside her cold coffee. "Didn't you say your mother made you jigger the clocks after she began to suffer from dementia?"
"Just a touch of dementia. Mother never got really bad. She always knew who she was. Mother always knew exactly who she was."
"You're made of better stuff than I am," Jane said. "When my grandmother suffered dementia, I couldn't deal with it." This was a lie. She had no grandmother with dementia. "I wanted to remember her only as she had been before her mind started to go. But you want to remember all of it, before and after." Although Jane had phrased her response as vague praise, Gossage detected the underlying suggestion that she found his maintenance of the backward-running clocks curious. He stopped stirring his coffee and used his right hand to pull thoughtfully on his chin, his gaze seeming to fix on a faraway shore, as if she inspired him to some philosophical consideration.
"It is a bit strange, I suppose. Maybe I'm too slow to let go. After all, it's been nearly 5 years.
4 years, 6 months, almost to the day," Jane quoted him.
"The clocks are beautiful and quite valuable," Gossage said. "I really should put them right. Maybe even sell some. After all, half as many would still keep her memory alive here."
His gaze returned from elsewhere, and he made a little production of noticing Gary's empty cup.
You like the coffee, Agent Burkett?
Yes, sir. Excellent.
Feel free to help yourself to more. Gossage gestured toward the coffee maker.
I believe I will,
Gary said, rising from his chair.
Agent Hawk, would you like to warm yours?
No, thank you. Caffeine makes me eat acid reducers like candy. Gossage had called his father a hard man. His mother seemed to have had her problems, too. Evil breeds in dysfunctional families, a truth Jane had known since she was 9. Her father, Martin Duroc, was a famous concert pianist. Women were drawn to him, and he wanted them all. Regretting his marriage, he killed Jane's mother, Vanessa, and staged it as a suicide. Young Jane had known he'd done it, but she'd found it difficult to believe what she knew, too confused and afraid to speak up. If her mother had shared with her the truth of Martin's many betrayals, 9-year-old Jane might have been better prepared to face facts and to bear witness against her father when evidence might have existed to corroborate her accusations. Now, Vanessa was long dead, while Martin performed to standing ovations. He looked at his full cup and, Jane believed, was sincerely surprised to find that he had not touched it. Perhaps he realized that ceaselessly stirring it had made him look nervous.
I like it cool, he said to explain himself.
He drank from the cup with feigned pleasure, but Jane saw him flinch slightly at the taste. 6.
When Jack first says he believes that Mama Dede Labrique's claim about backward-running clocks is true, that this house can be made to exist outside of time and allow them to live forever, Mercer wonders about his brother's sanity. However, he professes interest in Mama Dede and says nothing critical because there is Danica to consider. If Jack leaves, so will Danica, and after one experience of the girl, Mercer is addicted to her. She is a vigorous partner in the bedroom, but also thrillingly submissive. Thereafter, day by day, everything around Mercer fades, and only Danica remains vividly real. He is in a thick fog of desire, and the girl is such a light unto him that, like a moth enchanted by the flame of a candle, Mercer would press himself upon her even if the contact might set him afire. For a week, she services the twins in their separate rooms. On the 7th night when Mercer is with her, he is not surprised when Jack enters Mother's former private chamber and joins them in a menage a trois. On some level, Mercer has known this is inevitable. There is no awkwardness, not even for a moment, because when Mercer looks at Jack with the girl between them, he is not looking at a strange man, but only at himself. Already, Mercer and his brother anticipate each other's thoughts and finish each other's sentences. They were meant to be one, arising from a single egg fertilized by a single sperm, but the fertilized egg divided early in Brandywine's pregnancy. In the womb, they shared one amniotic sac and a single placenta, and now they share this woman, this house, one destiny. Jack supplies Danica with a variety of pills that she requires, and none is given for a medical reason. The pills generally sustain the girl in a buoyant mood, and for a few months she is mostly a delight to be around. Good at cards and other games, as funny as she is wildly erotic, quick to laugh, a good cook, never a nag, and always ready to be taken however they wish to take her. Jack photographs and makes videos of Danica. Looking at these makes Mercer feel as though he has stepped into one of those adult magazines or movies, into a life he has fantasized about ever since his mother introduced him to the world of eroticism. Mercer likes this feeling. He likes it very much.
Danica occasionally has days when she is troubled by what she calls blue meanies. She becomes sullen, caustic, argumentative. She will not be touched. It is on one of these days that life at Gossage Farm takes a new turn, although it is no more of a surprise than was the moment when Jack joined Mercer and Danica in bed. In her blue meanies, Danica insults Jack once too often, refuses to have sex, and he hits her. Hits her again. Mercer tries to stop Jack's assault by reminding him of the value that Danica has for them. But Jack is in a rage. Mercer has never seen anyone in such a rage. Jack scares him a little, which shouldn't be the case, because Jack is only Mercer himself, identical in all ways that matter. Jack says, "You think I've never had a bitch this hot? I've had dozens better than this, and they damn well don't say no to me. Aren't you bored with her, bro? I'm bored to death with the bitch. Variety, bro, variety, variety is the spice of life." Mercer does not want to participate in the beating of Danica, but he cannot look away. For some reason, Mercer cannot look away. Watching Jack beat the girl is like watching himself beat her, as though Mercer is standing outside of time, observing the life he might have lived if he hadn't lived the one as mother's pet. Jack is in a rage, a fury, but it doesn't seem to be the kind of anger that is harmful to the one who harbors it. Jack is clearly exhilarated in his rage. It is a happy anger. Jack even laughs as he curses Danica and hits her. Jack looks so powerful, as Mercer has never been. Jack doesn't accept rejection, doesn't take shit from anyone. His rage is like an act of nature, ferocious thunderstorm, tornado, earthquake, and in its way glorious to behold. Mercer wonders if Mother lied to him about the need to repress anger. She lied about everything else. Why not this too? Jack looks at Mercer and says, "Don't be a pussy, bro. Take your shot. She's just a user. A whore like all the other whores. They use you and throw you away like you're an old Kleenex full of snot. Well, they don't throw away Jackie Crockett anymore. I've got my major mojo working. They don't get away with pissing on me anymore. They pay for saying no to Jackie. You like being thrown away, boy? You like being a snot rag, boy? Right now you look as if you like being some whore snot rag. Find your mojo, man." This is not just Jack talking to Mercer. This is also Mercer talking to himself, expressing an anger that has been bottled in him for a long time, and maybe is even present in his blood, in his true father's genes, the anger of a pimp named Dewey Gorton. Mercer looks into Jack's eyes, which are Mercer's eyes, looks into Jack's soul, which is Mercer's soul, and knows himself for the first time. The girl is on the floor struggling to get up, and Mercer kicks her. The first kick makes him sick to his stomach, but the nausea passes. It passes so quickly, in mere seconds. Mercer kicks her again, and when she's eventually dead, the only regret Mercer feels is that they killed the whore in the kitchen instead of in Mother's former bedroom.
7. A sudden wind had come up, and the flying hard-shell beetles tapping at the windows had been chased to their boreholes and their nests. The currents of air buffeting the house and testing the panes of glass sounded wintry, although this was still the warm end of September, and now the muffled clocks couldn't be heard at all. On the farther side of the refrigerator, Gary Burkett stood at the coffee maker, pouring a second cup for himself. Mercer Gossage seemed to want to sell his preference for cold coffee, to eliminate any suspicion that he'd stirred it obsessively because he was nervous. "My mother liked coffee cold. I got a taste for it from her," Across the table from Gossage, Jane said, I lost my mother, Vanessa, when I was 9. She was a fine pianist. I wanted to be as good as her at the piano, as good as her in all things. Gossage appeared puzzled that she would open her personal life to him. He evidently knew this wasn't standard police procedure. He said,
Losing a mother is hard at any age, but when you're 9, that would have been a real heartbreaker. No one should have to endure that. I'm sorry to hear it. I'm real sorry.
His sympathy sounded awkward, forced. Kathy Haskell's mom said you lost your father when you were young. Gossage frowned, no doubt wondering why the murdered girl's mother would have mentioned Vernon Gossage. In fact, she had said only, Mercer is a sweet man, like his mom was sweet. Nothing like his worthless daddy. Probably was a good thing Uncle Vernon never had much influence on the child. Kathy would have gone off the rails all the way to the end of the line if not for how sweet Mercer was with her, steering her true again. Until Jane had met this man and grown wary of him, Mrs. Haskell's revelation of that bit of family history had seemed of no relevance to the search for the mother-hater. Maybe it still was of no relevance. But it gave her a small lever to pry at Gossage, and intuition said she needed to open his shell and have a look inside.
I was 16, Gossage said. My father loved his horses. One of them threw him, broke his neck. I wish I could say I admired him as much as you admired your mother, but he was a very hard man. My mother was an angel, but not him, not Vernon.
He picked up his spoon again and began to stir the brew that remained in his cup. Jane focused on his face as he stared into his cold coffee, and she said, My mother was murdered. The killer tried to stage it as suicide. I was the one who found her body. In the past, with most people, those words had drawn a look of surprise, even shock. And nearly always sympathy. Gossage didn't at once raise his head to look at her. His brow furrowed as though he might be struggling to understand why she continued with personal disclosures, whether they meant that she was in any way suspicious of him. When he raised his head and looked at her, the slight tremor in his voice would have been appropriate if he'd known her well enough and long enough to have an emotional reaction to the pain that her revelation suggested. But it was odd, considering that they had known each other only half an hour. If he had something to hide, however, then the tack that she'd taken might inspire a tremor of anxiety.
That's horrible. Dear God. For a little girl to find. That's the hardest thing I've ever heard.
As Gary Burkett turned away from the coffee maker, he seemed to freeze, his attention on the nearer of the two long-case clocks. Not the clock. A pegged perf board beside the clock, from which various keys dangle, one of them fixed to a ring bearing the Honda logo. Gary said,
Mr. Gossage, as a frustrated owner of a Honda, I have to ask, have you ever had transmission problems with yours?
Gary didn't own a Honda. He drove a Ford Explorer. His wife, Rosalind, drove a Subaru. However, Kathy Haskell's vintage Honda was still missing. 8.
Using a backhoe, Mercer and the other Mercer, who is Jack, buried Danica deep in what long ago was the hog pen. The farm has not been operative for decades, but Jack finds it fitting and amusing to stow the corpse in ground that he imagines is still rich with the fecal matter of swine. He says, This is where she belongs, the pig. Jack uses flour, corn flour, powdered brick, gunpowder, and other substances to draw an elaborate voodoo veve on her grave, as Mama Dede taught him. This ensures that she will not be found and that her spirit will not return here to haunt. Things are not the same on Gossage Farm without Danica. It is still summer, but a wintry dreariness settles over the house and land. The days pass without purpose. Mercer was so happy, and now he is not happy at all. On the fifth morning after the girl's death at breakfast, Mercer says, "I wish Danica was still here. It was nice having a pretty girl around." Jack smirked at him. "You wish she was here? Dug herself out, covered in dirt and pig shit, all broken up and walking dead? You know what I mean. Sure, I know. Nice to have Easy Tail around, something better to look at than you and me and the man in the mirror. Tomorrow I'll go off and find us an even better piece and bring her back." "Just like that?" Mercer says. "Didn't I tell you I've had lots better? You've been a mama's boy too long, bro. You don't know how to score. That's okay. I know the ladies, how they think, what they need. I'll find a juicy one." Mercer is dubious. "And this one you'll find, she'll have a taste for twins. Danica wasn't unique, bro. I'll get my Dewey Gorton on and go recruiting like our daddy did. You just do some housekeeping, catch up on the laundry while I'm away, and when I get back in a couple days, it'll be party time." Jack is gone 4 days. When he returns in his Chevy van, he has a girl, but it's not the same. She's pretty and all. 20 years old, maybe not much hotter than Danica, but at least as hot. However, she didn't come with Jack of her own free will. She's bound and sedated, and they have to carry her from the van into the house. Her name is Talia, and she is hot, but Mercer is at first a little disappointed because it is not the same. With Danica, they could play cards and watch movies, and she cooked, and they drank together, and she was funny, so there was a romantic quality to it. But Talia is afraid all the time and cries a lot. If they let her roam loose, she'll try to escape. They have to lock her in a room with boarded windows or keep her on a leash with a prong collar. The third day, Jack says, "She won't be like this forever, bro. She'll learn there's no way forward for her except total obedience. Once we break her, she'll be a good little pet and do what we want." "You ever done this before?" Mercer asks. "You ever just stole a girl instead of romancing her?" "Twice before. There's lots of them who can be romanced into doing anything, or they need someone to pay for their drugs. Then once in a while you see a piece so juicy, you just got to have her, but she refuses to be romanced and doesn't do drugs, so you need to take drastic action. You can't let nobody say no to you in this world, because once you start letting that happen, it never stops. It's always no, and you're finished." "Seems awful risky. Better to live 10 years as a king than 100 years as a peasant. Take what you want and stomp any bitch or son of a bitch who gets in your way. I got mucho mojo working for me, bro." Over the next 6 weeks, Talia is broken. She is so submissive that they can take the leash and prong collar off her, and she makes no attempt to escape. But for Mercer, it still isn't the same as with Danica. In some ways, it is not as much fun as with Danica, but in other ways, it is more fun. There is such an edge to it. When Mercer wanted Danica, he had to ask her, and sometimes she said, "Not right now," or even, "No." But Talia is not allowed to say no. Talia must do as she's told. Mercer discovers that when a girl must do as she is told, there are many more things you can think to do with her than you would try to do with a girl who could say no. It's a power trip, it really is. There's such an edge to the relationship. That edge is made even sharper by the awareness of how the relationship must end. With Danica, it didn't have to end as it had if only she had not insulted Jack too often.